Okay, everybody, let's get started. Take it as a standing invitation, too. Like at any point in class, if you want to get more pizza, do, because there's a lot of it there. So knock yourself out. Here's what we're going to do today for the last day of class. We're going to start by looking at this article called Enhancement Technologies in the Body, the article I had you read. I want to basically go through it, in particular for some of the vocabulary that's in there to give us a handle on what we're going to be talking about today. What we're talking about today is largely avatars and also the concept of the cyborg, which is to say we're trying to think about how not just digital technology, but technology gets understood as extension of the self, is basically what we're seeing, and where that causes both great possibility, but also great ethical sort of concern at the same time. So we're going to start on this article. Then we're going to turn and watch a few minutes from this documentary, Sound and Fury. Some of you were here in class maybe about 2 months ago, and we had a movie screening. We screened this film. If you didn't see it, no worries in the sense that we're going to watch maybe 5 or 10 minutes of it. And it's basically about a family, a deaf family, and one of the family members is considering getting a cochlear implant, and we're going to talk about that in conjunction with this article that I had you read called Do Signals Have Politics? About thinking about the technological concern about cochlear implants in relationship to the way that technology can possibly provide possibility, but also at the same time threaten community or culture, what have you. Those of you who are in Jonathan's neuroethics class, I hear that you had yesterday a speaker with somebody who has cochlear implants, so it'll be interesting to hear your thoughts based on what you heard yesterday. The second half of class, we're going to be turning towards the avatar, so we're turning to digital media technology and trying to think about, if we're trying to think about community, identity, and authenticity in connection to how technology is an extension of the human, in terms of something like a cochlear implant, in terms of a technology and ability, what does that mean to think of that in a digital presence or sense online? That's what we're going to talk about. So let's start by pulling out this article by Linda Huggle, Enhancement Technologies and the Body. Any questions before we start, though? Okay, I'm not going to linger too long on this because, like I said, I just kind of want to get some terminology out for us. So this is on page 696, the first page of the article, from the introduction. It reads, some scholars suggest bodies as they now exist are an arbitrary evolutionary solution to issues of mobility, communication, and functioning in the environment. If this is true, the solution we have may not be the best one. Bodies are imperfect, variable, and in a state of constant degeneration and needed repair. This state of affairs may be changing as innovations in biomedicine and bioengineering make it possible to alter biological form and function. A belief in the technological ability to improve on the body's natural capabilities, along with cultural assumptions about what is considered to be deficient, normal, or enhanced, have led to a variety of body-altering techniques that not only repair or replace functions, but may go beyond what is typically considered therapeutic medical intervention. In essence, the ability exists to redesign the human body according to particular needs and desires, altering or building in new futures. Now, we're going to be talking about cochlear implants a little bit, but this kind of body alteration is of all different forms, from plastic surgery to LASIK eye surgery to hair removal, laser hair removal, to any kind of way in which we can alter for cosmetic, stylistic, or disability or ability sort of reasons. The terms I want to pull out here are the ones that are in quotes. These are deficient, normal, and enhanced. And in particular, how these terms might actually be not as fixed as we like to think they are. So turning the page, page 697, we get a definition of what the middle term, this concept of normal, might possibly mean. This is on the right-hand column at the bottom of page 697. The concept of normal is a relatively recent addition to the English language, adapted for use in biological states only around the mid-19th century. Davis, Hacking, Locke, Porter, and Sinding and others provide excellent accounts of the conditions that led to changes in thinking about normality, health, and disease, including the rise of statistics. In brief, older ideas about the health necessity of balanced bodily states of excesses and deficiencies were augmented by later findings about pathology that could be generalized to populations. Measurements of individuals and populations were collected and yielded a distributed range of data points on everything from physical traits and intelligence to behaviors, initiating the concept of a normal curve. Most people fall within the main range of the curve, but others are considered to be outliers. The further one is from the hypothetical statistically average person, the norm being the center point of a curve, the more likely he or she is to be defined as not normal, etc., etc. This is basically telling us that with the rise in the 19th century of statistical analysis, and I'll even be more specific, with the rise of biology as a distinct discipline, just to say a more general sort of study of the life sciences, we start to see a kind of quantification of what varieties might or might not look like in nature and such. This curve, of course, is what we're talking about. It's kind of a standard sort of bell curve, which is to say normality gets understood in terms of how one is most closely connected to the general population or the largest percentage of the population. This sounds like a no-brainer, but basically it's this idea that this idea of there being a constitutive idea, statistically, scientifically, pathologically, of what is normal, is historically speaking a kind of recent thing. It's really only from the last sort of couple hundred years. To that end, when we think about things like technology enhancing and altering bodies, we think we're talking about very current phenomena, and we are in some ways. But the most current of that phenomena is the most important of those current phenomena might be just the idea of trying to know what a normal body might actually look like. That's basically what we have here. So, looking at the next paragraph, this next paragraph talks about this in connection to this idea of disability. Or we could say deficiency, if you want to think about those three terms we have up on the board. Leonard Davis, who I'm about to cite here, is sort of a leading disability theory scholar. And what he's basically taking here in this next paragraph is sort of this idea of what is it to think about normality in relationship towards disability or even ability. It says, Leonard Davis would call this an institutional state of normalcy, as distinguished from normality, the state of being physically normal. He understands this to be, quote, the political, juridical, institutional state that relies on the control and normalization of bodies, unquote. Key to the institutional state of normalcy is the use of statistics to delineate individuals into groups and to describe their position as they fall within or outside of expected norms. Classifications and definitions can then be used by governmental or medical authorities to create guidelines for how to deal with things and people outside the norms. For example, the Americans with Disabilities Act in the United States and the National Survey of Disabled Persons in China could thus define who is normal or disabled, and consequently, who should receive which kind of care. Outliers can more easily become targets for intervention, as Kevlis, Pernick, and others demonstrated with the history of eugenics. Physical conditions can be given political significance because the non-standards may be perceived as costly to a society, both economically and politically. It then becomes conceivable to attempt to norm the non-standard or defectives using social scientific programs. The basic sort of argument here that's being made is just this idea that about what we constitute as normal is a politically loaded sort of thing, a scientifically sort of loaded thing, and a culturally loaded sort of thing. To that end, while it is statistics and the rise of a host of specialized sciences that gave rise to the notion of normality, and to that degree we think that they are non-biased, almost quantifiable things that determine what bodies are normal, there's still a loaded quality in terms of trying to define what a normal body looks like. And because there is, that also means it can be a skewed concept at the same time. So what we have here in trying to think about what a normal body is, and all of this being a prefatory sort of discussion towards if we're talking about avatars and cyborgs and supplementing the body and how that's ethically problematic, we're doing all of that in contrast to, in reaction to, well, what does a normal body look like? And if my body is deficient, then how can I bring it up to normal? Or if my body is normal, how can I make it enhanced? Well, that notion of normal is a moving target. As much as it seems rooted in statistics, it's actually rooted in politics and culture and all sorts of different sort of loaded sort of historical things. And to that degree, how ethically problematic we feel about being deficient or normal or enhanced is actually on a very sort of unstable sort of ground, because that notion of normal isn't just what's the average height in America? Let's think how tall somebody is. Do I want to add or take off a few inches from my height? And so on. Because what we can think of as normal might not just be statistical, but might actually be personal or cultural in some sort of way. Any questions about that? Seems like a general sort of point, but actually it's a significant one to think about in terms of the spectrum that we have in these three terms. All right, let's look at just a couple of more terms here in this article before we sort of give ourselves a pause. This is on page 699. So this is in a section called Enhancement Technologies and Bioethics. It reads, so if we've talked a bit about normal and deficiency here in these past two, this is about enhancement or enhanced bodies. Much of the existing literature on enhancement technologies comes from bioethicists. It arose from debates about the increasing use of anabolic steroids and other drugs to enhance athletes' performances in the 1980s, as well as the expanding use of human growth hormone for short children made possible with recombinant molecular techniques at about the same time. Primarily concerned with the moral permissibility of extending human capabilities, bioethicists were also occupied with questions about the obligations of physicians to provide certain treatments when they may not be warranted or medically necessary. As the number and type of available enhancements expanded, many felt that enhancements should be thought of in the same category as futile treatments, that is, beyond medical responsibility. Enhancement thus drew attention to the problem of defining the proper goals of medicine and distinguishing these from social goals and values. In the oft-cited case of HGH, for example, treatment for a child with a condition resulting in retarded growth would be considered therapy. However, a short child of short parents could also suffer social consequences because of average or even tall stature may improve an individual's chances for life success, and on and on. This sort of category is sort of a chestnut or a hallmark sort of part of bioethics, which is to say, when are we obligated to provide medicine, and when is medicine overstepping and providing a kind of supplementary, extra sort of care? But that discourse and that sort of cornerstone of what bioethical discourse looks like is based and predicated on this spectrum of what is normal, what is deficient, and what is enhanced, and how a certain kind of care, a certain kind of technological advancement in one scenario might be seen as superfluous or luxury, and another it might be seen as sort of ethically necessary on the other hand. I mention this only to say that if we're already talking about sort of the moving target of whether or not what is a normal or enhanced or deficient body, then even if we can find a certain kind of enhancement or a certain kind of technology that can be seen to enhance or render deficient a body, that might be very different for how it is for you versus how it is for Brenda versus how it is for me. Because what conditions we have and what place we have in life and what culture we come from also changes. To that end, the hard part about today's discussion, taking for example a cochlear implant, is that in one instance a cochlear implant might be seen as an absolutely appropriate and non-problematic kind of enhancement with which to render a body either normal or enhanced. In another circumstance, in another family, in another culture, in another time, in another economic situation, it might not seem that way. So technologies themselves are not inherently singularly ethically appropriate or inappropriate or circumstantially right or wrong, that those two sort of shift and vary. The point being is that this spectrum of deficient, normal, enhanced is actually one that's negotiated, depending on the person, depending on the circumstance, depending on the technology, such that in certain circumstances, my body could probably fall in any one of those three categories. So the need to supplement my body with technology of some variety to move from one category to another might vary, depending on what issue we're talking about, and what circumstance, and what part of my body, so to speak. Again, may seem like a no-brainer, but actually it's a kind of significant thing to think about. I want to direct you just towards a couple of passages here before we look at a few things in the film here. This is on page 701. If you guys aren't familiar with, and those of you who have taken Jonathan's classes certainly will be, and maybe even Autumn's, on page 701 in the right-hand column, there's a paragraph that starts, "Many anthropologists influenced by Foucault, dot, dot, dot." Get a chance, take a look at that paragraph. It's a pretty good summary of what we mean by biopower and biomedicine. Does everybody know what those terms are? Let's start with biopower. Anybody? And I don't need a precise definition, just a loosey-goosey one will sort of do.
The power within the knowledge of the medicine. Like, I believe it's like sort of, it's kind of Foucauldian because it usually has to do with like the power of knowledge, I believe.
Yeah. Foucault's almost concern almost always isn't just power, but the way that power is circumstantially understood in terms of bodies of knowledge, discourses, forms of discussion, and so on, and institutions is what he's talking about. Biopower is the fact that even when inherent within one's own body, the manipulation of the body and the situation of that body in some place culturally, problematically, historically, has its own kind of power or agency attached to it. To that end, to think about biopower has many manifestations, but one of those being the power that one has to manipulate one's own body, but the power that one has with which to also affect the manipulation of many others as well at the same time. Really, it comes from the fact, like I told you, in the 19th century, we see the birth of what is biology. Prior to biology, do you know what we called that field of science? Anybody who's been to a museum? the big biology museum in any city knows what it's called. Natural History is what it used to be called. So prior to the 19th century, we referred to the life sciences as natural history. To that end, we almost in some ways had some more specific parts of biology before we actually had biology itself. Now, this distinction is important because what we're talking about here is this idea that we can have a study of life itself as a category, how it's understood in all its forms and manipulations, and the relationship between all those forms of life is not surprisingly absolutely a 19th century invention. To that degree, one of the greatest influencers in the creation of biology was something like the theory of evolution, because this idea that lots of forms of life can actually be connected and worthy of study together under one umbrella is positively a 19th century sort of concept. So with the rise of statistics and with the rise of biology and with the rise of the life sciences and with the rise of this decision to want to define what is normal and deficient or enhanced, basically, all of these being 19th century inventions, there is not surprisingly absolutely a power that is attached to the way with which we read, study, analyze, diagnose, staticize, and render deficient, enhanced, or normal bodies themselves. This is biopower we're talking about. And our attempt to want to use technology or the internet or a cochlear implant is an attempt on our part to want to engage in biopower, you know? And the thing is, we do this all the time every day, too. We do it when we wear contact lenses or when we brush our teeth or when we take a shower or wear deodorant. I mean, in small ways, we're engaging in forms of biopower. Today we're talking about some of those more exaggerated ones. The term I actually want to turn us to now is perhaps the most important one for today, and this is on page 702. Right-hand column, bottom of page 72. Ironically, as individuals select among bodily practices and modifications to suit both external expectations and a sense of fulfillment, a question of authenticity arises. Eliot asks the question, is this an authentic self or one invented by altering the biology through surgery, medicines, or devices, and imagined through advertising media, health advisory groups, or other images? Authenticity is really the big word for today. And all those examples I mentioned about, you know, whether we brush our teeth or whether we cut our hair, whether we get LASIK surgery, whether we wear contact lenses, whether I get laser hair removal, whether I shave my legs, whether I get braces, whether I get plastic surgery, whether I get a cochlear implant, whether I become a cyborg, on and on, the whole spectrum, you know? All of these are loaded questions that have to do with, is this the authentic, real me? So I come in today, and I stink to high heaven because I didn't put deodorant on or take a shower. And someone's like, what is that? That's me. Authentic. You know, one could say that, you know. Having said that, the decision to shower and wear deodorant and brush your teeth and mouthwash and floss and all that sort of stuff might actually be, this actually is the more authentic me because it's the person I want to present to the world. Even that small moment, even those kinds of gestures are biopower. What we're concerned with today are really significant ethical questions about authenticity. So we are bearing in mind the whole spectrum of what a deficient, a normal, and an enhanced body is, how biopower and biomedicine speak to those questions, and how authenticity is at the heart of all the questions we're talking about today. But today, I'm having us look at two issues, and I'm going to segue into the first one now. The first is the cochlear implant. It's such a hot issue to talk about in disability studies and in bioethics, I think because of the fact that in that whole range of different ways with which we can enhance or not enhance a body, it perhaps seems to be one of the most extreme sort of ones. Because of the fact that it's almost like a miracle, the way that it happens, and because it literally almost reminds us of, like, are we on the road to cyborgs? Like, am I becoming half person, half machine sort of thing? You know, it's sort of the worry. So, in that sense, the cochlear implant becomes at once one of the most humane sort of things we can give to someone with a disability, but it also becomes one of the things with which we almost feel like feels the most inhumane, in the sense that it almost renders someone robotic in some strange way. Not that that's true, or not that that's false, but it explains why it's a troubling sort of impasse. Before I turn away from this article, I just want to direct you towards page 703. Those of you who aren't familiar with cyborg theory, there's a couple of good paragraphs here on page 703. Cyborg theory was really hot, like in the 1990s, this idea that, like, most of it was largely hypothetical in the type of work it was doing. What if one day we could merge this, that, and the other and create some sort of so on and so forth? And the reason cyborg theory has sort of not been as big, I'd say, in the last 10 years is the fact that we've taken off so much in digital media. So the idea of the future being less about turning myself into a machine than actually about the fact that I can have an alter ego in some way that exists digitally, electronically. Essentially, that's what we're talking about today. We're talking about the literal fusion of technology and body with the cochlear implant. And the second issue we're talking about today, this idea of digital testimony online as a kind of alternate identity, the avatar, as being a way of, instead of merging technology with myself, how do I take myself and put it into the machine, the technology, in some sort of way? So those are the two issues we're going to look at. What I want to do right now is show about 5 or 10 minutes from this documentary, Sound and Fury. It was Oscar-nominated when it came out in 2000. It's largely kind of sentimental, really, in the way that it sort of looks at the issue of how does cochlear implant technology separate deaf communities, how does it cause strife within families of deaf children and deaf parents, and how is it actually a savior for many families and many people. Like I said, we had this screening class weeks ago, but I just kind of wanted to show a small clip. So if you haven't gotten pizza or a drink or you want to get some more, perfect time, because I watch a little movie and eat a bit. So I'm going to start the movie. This is a scene where we begin by a family. We have a family here, a deaf family, husband and wife for both deaf. They have several children, one of whom is deaf with some slight hearing, and they're thinking about maybe getting her a cochlear implant. Now, the hard part about cochlear implants for the deaf community, of course, is the fact that one can absolutely provide some semblance of hearing through a cochlear implant, but does that also create distance then from the deaf community, from one's deaf family members, so on and so forth? So in this scene, the family, having pause about whether or not they want to get a cochlear implant for their daughter, are going to visit another family whose child was deaf and they got a cochlear implant for. In this case, however, the family they're going to visit is of two hearing parents who had a deaf child. So very different scenario, but they're going to ask questions and sort of get parental feedback. So.
In New Jersey. She's 10 years old, and her whole family is deaf, just like us. New Jersey is really, really far, like 60 miles. We'd drive for hours and hours and days and days. And find...
Try this again.
And finally we'll arrive.
The volume isn't great, I apologize for that.
This is Sam.
Diane. And Nancy. This is Heather, Peter, and Nita.
Do you like the implant?
Of course I like it.
Can you use a telephone?
Yes, with something I plug into my processor.
Can you hear a baby cry?
She can hear a snake tail rattle.
I saw a snake. I could hear it, yes.
Snake is very dangerous. It can choke you. Can you hear the animals in the zoo? The bears growl?
Yes, I can hear animals growl. Any animal.
Can you hear a house collapse?
I never saw a house do that.
Can you hear a car crash?
You think cars crash every day?
I saw it happen one time.
Oh, yeah, one time.
Can you hear a ghost say boo?
I've never seen a ghost.
Boo! Oh, I have another question. Can you hear different people talking at school?
Well, really, no one just speaks. All the kids in my class are deaf, so they sign too. And sometimes they don't speak at all. But when I play with my hearing friends and use my cochlear implant, sometimes I understand them and sometimes I don't.
Oh, really? Because I've heard people say that with a cochlear implant, you can understand everything. No, not 100% like hearing.
So can you show me how well you speak?
My name is Daisy. My brother's name is Marvin. My mom's name is Diane. My daddy's name is Sharon. I live in Atlantown. In New Jersey. I have two babies. Hey, my dog.
Nancy speaks sometimes at home, but being deaf, we can't tell if her speech is any good. So I ask my parents, and they tell me she speaks very well. Like perfect. Who do you socialize most with, hearing or deaf?
mostly deaf people.
Your family is deaf, and all your friends are deaf. So how do you feel that you're the only family with an implant? How does that feel? We never thought about it. We're positive people. There's no room for negativity here. We just want her to be happy. I've got one last question. Which do you like better, wearing a hearing aid or having the implant? What do you prefer?
I prefer the cochlear implant. I really do.
I gotta say, I appreciate your openness. This is making us feel better. You're giving us good feedback. You know, I'm getting information from so many hearing people. I've had enough of that. We're deaf. You know what I mean? We're the same. Forget hearing people.
I still need proof that the cochlear implant works. I want to make sure it would be right for him.
So Robin was actually visiting with another deaf family, and now they're going to school, I think, to see a young girl.
Look at my implant.
I got it 2 years ago. There's a microphone. The microphone goes on here. And now I hook up, and now I can hear. Now I can hear. I lost my hearing when I was already grown up. You want to touch it? You want the same? See this? Look at the processor. That's louder. Good girl. I like it very much. Makes everything loud. I can hear. I can hear birds. Heather, do you hear birds now? No.
No, I'll hear them later.
Do you want to tell me why you want a cochlear implant?
Because hearing people don't sign.
Do you have good speech? Let me hear your voice. Shelby, Heather wants to get a cochlear implant. Like Helena, like Lindsay, like Shelby, like who else?
Danielle.
Christopher?
Why is everybody talking and no one signs?
Because this school focuses on speaking.
Who? All of them?
Yes. At this school, they teach using speech.
How do they feel?
Feel about what? The implant?
Shelby, how do you like your cochlear?
I don't like it. So I can hear better. Do you want to play?
Shelby, ask her, would you like to eat something?
Do you want something to eat?
Shelby, take her hand.
Yeah?
Take her hand.
It was such a struggle for Heather. She tried to communicate with them, but none of them knew how to sign, and they knew nothing about deaf culture. So they don't have any deaf identity or self-esteem. I feel bad for them, because they're only focusing on speech. It's because they all have hearing parents. I have to do more research, because I want Heather to have both worlds, to be able to go back and forth, to speak and to sign.
You remember Heather?
Heather is thinking about getting an implant, like you. See, right now she has hearing aids. Can we show Heather your implant? This is Shelby's cochlear implant. It has given her what she never could have gotten from hearing aids. This is the magnet that helps Shelby to hear. And underneath, if you take it off, you see? If you feel it, there's a little bump. Do you want to feel it? Feel it? That's the internal part. That's the part that they do when they have surgery. Shelby wants to sing to you.
Okay, go ahead.
Wheels on a bus go round and round, round and round, round and round. The wheels on a bus go round and round, all through the town.
As the interpreter, did you understand what Shelby was saying? Were the words clear to you?
Yes, I understand her clearly. Her voice was very clear. Yes.
I'm just explaining to Shelby she doesn't understand the use of sign language because she's never been exposed to it. They can't hear anything either. And they don't have an implant and they don't have hearing aids. So this is the way they know how to talk. Okay?
Okay.
Give it to Heather and let her read like you read, okay?
Okay.
Heather, why don't you sign? The interpreter will speak. If you sign, then she'll voice for you.
No, I don't want to sign. I want to speak.
Sign the story. It's your language.
No.
You sign, no. She'll speak.
Just leave her be.
Stop.
Now, come on. I want you to sign the story, Heather.
I
want to
speak.
All right. All right. Let her be.
All right.
The piano. No. Yes, Spot. Is he under the bed?
Yes.
Try the basket.
Okay, I know that we come from a deaf world and you are from the hearing world, but I want to know if you did any research to find out about deaf history or sign language before you had the implant done on your daughter, or did you just go ahead with it without any real information?
I guess we both felt that there were more options available to her if she were able to hear. That life for her would be easier, more normal, where she wouldn't have any restrictions. Even a profession, you know, such as surgeons, I mean, something so simple, but if you can't rely on sign language and do surgery.
Does Shelby think of herself as a deaf person or a hearing person?
Yes, I'd like to know that. What is her view of herself? Do you have any idea how she views herself with the cochlear implant?
She views herself as a hearing person. Without doubt, she definitely does. She doesn't know the deaf life at all.
Do you want to go outside with Heather and play? Ask Heather if she wants to play with you.
You want to play?
It seems that with a cochlear implant, she doesn't use sign language. Why? Don't you allow it? When Shelby 6 or 7, if she comes to you then and wants to sign, will you tell her no, or will you let her do it?
They feel, from the professionals that we've spoken to, speech therapists, etc., that sometimes the children may use it as a crutch and not be able to fully develop their speech and language. I know the deaf culture is a very, very important part of your life, and I guess it's hard for us to understand why you would want to keep Heather in that world and not broaden her horizons.
Oh, we would love for Heather to get involved with both worlds. Deaf people, hearing people, everything. But the point of this for us is that we're worried that the cochlear implant will change her identity. It was really wrong for me to meet them. I felt they were smothering me and they thought I was stupid. But I'm just trying to do what's best for my family. Maybe Shelby's family feels ashamed of her deafness or embarrassed. Shelby's going to grow up thinking she was implanted because it's bad to be deaf.
Nita, she's happy in the hearing world. Leave her alone. Why does she have to have a deaf identity?
Because she doesn't even know what her deafness is. She has no idea because her parents didn't tell her she's deaf. She asks, what is sign language? Mary, what is that? I felt so bad. That must really hurt. She doesn't sign at all. Not even one word. And she acts like a hearing person. Why is it so important to be deaf? Yes, deaf people have beautiful language, but you miss out on so many other beautiful things in the world, like music. I don't care about music. I can't hear it. It's hearing a baby cry for the first time, or being outside and hearing the beautiful rain. You can hear the rain falling on the ground. Mary, you don't understand. Wait a minute. You are hearing. You can hear. I never hear. For me, this is normal. I can see the beautiful rain. I can taste the rain on my lips. It doesn't matter to me to hear it. It makes no sense to me. But Nita, you never experienced hearing. I know what you're missing. I thought about everything everyone said to me, and I've decided to just disregard it and from now on make the decisions for myself. People have been saying, oh, the cochlear implant is going to make it better for Heather. She'll be able to communicate better. But I think my husband and I are going to do our best to give her a good education so she'll be able to have a good life without the implant.
Okay, stop there. So, let's just share some of the things that we're talking about here with cochlear implants in particular, sort of their concern. If you turn to page 321 on this article, Do Signals Have Politics? I want to start by just reading a paragraph here that sort of talks about what's the background bioethically related to cochlear implants. Then I kind of want to throw it to the floor and talk a bit about what we just saw. Those of you who are in Jonathan's neuro class can share a bit about what you heard yesterday in the class. But let's start with this paragraph. Bottom of page 321, right-hand column, or I guess it's page 321. Concurrent with their entrenchment in futurist discourse, and a futurist discourse we're going to get to in a second, but this idea being that something akin to the fact that cochlear implants are absolutely an amazing technology of the present, that they almost feel like science fiction in the way that they're able to provide something amazing like that. That's sort of the futurism we're talking about here. Cochlear implants quickly entered the canons of bioethics and disability studies, raising questions about the definition of impairment, the feasibility of pediatric informed consent, and the cost-effectiveness of neuroprostheses. Many bioethicists have taken up the deaf culture or linguistic minority critique of implantation, which situates this technology in the long history of eugenicist attempts to promote oralism through the medical eradication of deafness through pedagogical bans on sign language. Despite the prominence of the cochlear implant in disability studies, bioethics, and science fiction, however, it has inspired little research in science and technology studies. Stuart Bloom, a sociologist of science and parent of a deaf child and of a hard-of-hearing child, conducted the most substantial fieldwork in the 1990s on the reception of implants in France, the United States, England, Sweden, and the Netherlands. Bloom detected two very different accounts of cochlear implantation. One is a tale of medicine's triumph, akin to many other such tales, a tale of courageous pioneers of the wonders of medical science and technology. The other is in a genre which has emerged only in the past two decades and which highlights the subordination of medicine to surveillance, to social control, and normalization. This is a tale of the oppression of the deaf, of hearing society's inability to accept deaf people for what they are. Yet more than one identity group is accommodated within the category of deafness. It includes members of deaf culture, self-defined as linguistic minorities, who sign, and whose disability is largely an effect of the built environment and social stigma, late deafened adults who tend to claim disability from hearing loss, and oral deaf and hard-of-hearing individuals of all ages. Without rejecting Bloom's assertions about the deaf response to cochlear implants, it is possible to write a third history of this technology, a history that includes the active participation of late deafened volunteers in research and development, and at the same time depicts their distinctive patterns of stigmatization and exclusion. In The Artificial Ear, Cochlear Implants and the Culture of Deafness, published in 2010, Bloom largely maintains his focus on deaf culture and the debate surrounding pediatric implantation. He concludes, "The demands of deaf community leaders and advocates had little or no effect either on development of the cochlear implant or on the beginnings of local implantation practices. The experience of deaf people was not accepted as essential or even as relevant." All right, let's walk through this paragraph a little bit to talk about some of the things that are mentioned. Let me turn this off. Great. So, first of all, you notice in here are several times the word deaf is listed. It's listed with a capital D. For those of you who may not be familiar, within deaf culture, there's usually a distinction that's sometimes made
between deaf people and deaf people. Capital D, lowercase d. Capital deaf people are persons who sign, for the most part, people who are fluent in sign language. More specifically, they're often people who are hard of hearing or deaf, who come from parents or families of people who are deaf as well. People who are entrenched in deaf culture, in terms of not just language, but also familiarly and culturally, these are the capital D deaf. People who are deaf and tend to be the children of speaking or hearing people, and don't know sign, or aren't at least fluent in sign, are sometimes referred to as lowercase d deaf. Now, having said that, there's all kinds of politics within deaf culture about whether or not one makes sure to use that term or not, makes that distinction. But there's also a whole host of people that feel that there's also something kind of prejudicial in making that distinction between people who might have the exact same hearing ability or inability or disability, so to speak, but that makes no difference. Culturally, there's something different, and that's where the D distinction comes from. I spotlight that to begin with because in many ways it seems that cochlear implants are a triumph over physical deafness, but in many ways what they're a challenge to is this very distinction right here. Capital D deaf, lower key D deaf, and just the fact that there's nuance within deaf culture and deaf community, and the cochlear implant as a technology and as an intervention seems in some way to obliterate nuance in that particular way. To that end, here's a couple of things that are listed in this paragraph, just so we can walk through and know what we're talking about here. The three main features that are sort of being questioned by cochlear implants, most often by bioethicists and disability studies, are: what is the definition of impairment? Or in other words, that sliding scale of deficient, normal, enhanced, how is a cochlear implant playing with, registering with that particular vehicle? The feasibility of pediatric informed consent. So in other words, this documentary is a perfect example of that, in the sense that a large percentage of people who are getting cochlear implants absolutely are children, which is part of what's concerning about it. People who have not had a chance sometimes to become fluent in sign language, or who are young enough that if they start to hear, they could lose their ability to sign. It's kind of like I have a lot of, if you have, know somebody who has a who has kids and the nanny speaks another language, they're a Swedish au pair, or there's somebody who's from, you know, Colombia or someplace like that, those little kids, when they're being taken care of by the other, to 2, 3, 4 years old, they are speaking Swedish or French or Spanish or what have you. By the time those kids hit first, second grade or what have you, they've lost the ability to speak if that nanny's not still there, so to speak. There's a worry about that with sign language as well. So a young child can be quite fluent in sign language, but the fear is that with the ability to hear at such a young age coming into a deaf child, they may lose that sign language ability. So that's sort of the worry about the pediatric informed consent in terms of what choice do they have. And then the last thing that's listed here is cost effectiveness of neuroprostheses. In other words, what is the payoff in terms of not just the expense of what cochlear implants is, but what's the cost, not just in dollars and cents, but culturally at the same time. So to that end, let's turn this to you guys right now to hear some of your thoughts about, in this documentary, in thinking about cochlear implants, what are the ways in which you think it can speak to a problem with its own biopower? Asked another way, what gives this mother pause, would you say, in this documentary? Actually?
For undergrad, I went to a school called RIT that houses something called NTID, which is the National Technical Institute for the Deaf. And we have a huge deaf culture on campus. I want to say probably a third of our population is either deaf or hard of hearing. A number of them have cochlear implants. And the deaf culture themselves ostracize individuals who have cochlear implants. So I think that part of the mother's worry is that the family themselves are so entrenched in deaf culture. The mother and the father themselves are deaf. They participate really heavily in the deaf community. If you watch the rest of the movie, I mean, you know, they're big power players in the deaf community, both, you know, sort of nationally, I would say, but also especially within the area that they live. And I think that the mother's afraid that if she gets a cochlear implant, all of a sudden all of her deaf friends are going to ostracize her because they feel as though it's a rejection of their own culture.
Good. So one way to put this would be this idea that given how loaded cochlear implants are within the deaf community, the decision here isn't just about the ability or disability or capabilities of the daughter, but it's almost like making a political decision to choose one side or the other. The name of this article is "Do Signals Have Politics?" Well, so do healthcare choices. And in this case, the decision not just to get a cochlear implant oneself, but even for one child, signifies what is going to be afraid here is this a disloyalty to my community by letting my child have a cochlear implant. So cultural politics is one worry here. What's another? A couple more. Sam?
Well,
this idea of passing, that in a sense that the daughter will be able to pass in another community and no longer be, in a sense, part of the other community, and that, in a sense, could the daughter, like, in a sense, outgrow the community that she's, in a sense, a part of.
Yeah.
Because clearly the parents and even the grandparents inside the film were clearly a part of the other community, and so in a sense she would no longer, she would fit into that community, but she also wouldn't fit into that community.
Yeah, I mean, this is, in other words, we think that this is going to provide, and I think the hope for the mother here is the fact that I would love for her to be able to have hearing culture, but I want her to retain the deaf culture at the same time. The hope is that a cochlear implant can provide mobility, movement between cultures, but the fear is that it might actually cause one to leave entirely a different sort of community. Actually,
well, it's not even leave entirely, but I mean, I witnessed this firsthand a lot. Individuals with cochlear implants are not considered deaf. If you have a cochlear implant, you are not allowed to participate in deaf culture the same way that you would be if you only had a hearing aid, or if you have nothing at all and you're sign only. I tried to make friends with some deaf kids on my freshman floor, and I was told that they couldn't be friends with me because their deaf friends didn't like that they associated with hearing people. Choosing a cochlear implant isn't the ability to go between deaf culture and hearing culture. For deaf individuals, people who really identify as capital D deaf, choosing a cochlear implant is actively denying deaf culture and choosing to remove yourself from it. So you're not allowed to be a member of deaf culture if you have any hearing at all, realistically.
Yeah. I think you're all point taken well, Ashton, but I think your campus seems to have definitely had the extreme version about whether you're loyal or disloyal, because there certainly is possible in this world to have a cochlear implant and still be a part of deaf culture. Having said that, probably given the history, and what Ashton's actually referring to is, this is the important thing to realize, all different disabilities have communities, but there's something about deaf culture. There really is, where it is just a really, really, really rich, unique kind of disability. And I'll tell you why. It's because they have their own language, they have their own customs, they have their own gestures, they have their own dance, they have their own festivals. They have, I mean, literally, it is literally like its own, I don't want to say ethnicity, but it's so rich, it's so deep in all of the ways it has so much culture surrounding it. This is why it's different than, say, getting LASIK surgery, or it's different than, say, trying to repair some sort of small sort of like disability that one might have in some other way. Deaf culture is rich and deep, and I'll give an example, and actually school is a good example. We have schools for the deaf, and communities for the deaf, and retirement homes for the deaf, and vacation plans for the deaf, and I know this historically in the history of medicine. If you go back to the 19th and 18th century, there's whole hosts of things like cooking for the deaf, you know, vacationing for the deaf, quilting as a group for the deaf. I mean, there's that much kind of like sort of a unique sort of culture that sort of happens there. In fact, one of the things that's so threatening about cochlear implants really does come down to the question of sign language, because if anybody knows sign language, in many ways it's actually a much more rich, nuanced form of language than actually the English and the speech and the writing that we actually use. So nuanced and so precise is it. To that end, sign language gets the cultural impression of being sort of this cobbled together series of sort of gestures that's trying to live up to the standard of what our written and speech sort of looks like. Truth of the matter is, most linguists tend to agree that sign language in many ways exceeds what our particular speech is. So thinking of deficiency and normalcy and enhancedness, we can enhance a person who has deaf by giving them the ability to hear. What we may also be providing them with, if we take away their sign language, is a more deficient form of language and communication. So this is a part of what that trade-off is and that worry in particular. Anybody else, thoughts from this documentary or from the article that you read today about things that seem to be to give pause about cochlear implants? Yes, Sam.
But one thing that I know sounds kind of a bit sort of crazy or a little bit off the cuff is that, like, the thing is that, like, the people that get the cochlear implants, you know, and they get it and then don't learn sign language, what I think is kind of a bit dangerous is that they're learning how to speak, but then what happens if, like, you know, there's like a disruption in power, or there's a disruption in the technology where they have to, how do they survive without having some other form of communication? Mm-hmm. And then I think that what I was always never really understood is why don't you learn both? You know, so like if there is a disruption, you know how to.
Well, I mean, that's a you heard a loud gunshot went off by your ear and you lost your hearing. How would you communicate with somebody right now?
Probably just
right, gesture, your mouth, something. You know, I mean, yeah. I think that's the thought that would happen there. None of us are learning sign language for the rare occasion that we lose our hearing, as power goes out or something like that. You know, so I think that's the worry, is that because of, barring some extreme example like you can think of, Sam, the default is going to be like, why should I keep up with my sign? Yeah.
There's also the risk benefit ratio. You're having, especially in this, a lot of these cases, a child undergoes surgery. For this, and it's not just that you can, you know, put it on their ear and then they start hearing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a
photo in here, and they showed us a bit on there. This is on page 333 in this article, but I mean, basically, it's partly an implantation and partly an external, so it's half internal, half external. Which is to say that one worries that, is it problematic if we render routine? The way we deal with deafness in children is to perform basically brain surgery on them. Like, that's worrisome if brain surgery becomes a routine thing to do with the entire population of kids.
I've also heard the argument that this entire experience can be revisionist, that some people say that, you know, to be a hearing person and to immediately dismiss the concern of the deaf community is revisionist. You're forgetting the history, but also I think from the deaf community's point of view, they also forget that, yes, the language exists and the culture exists, but I think it didn't spring out of the fact that, you know, this is a cultural development that grew up around the community. It was, I mean, sign language, you know, was developing, expand over time as a way to facilitate the communication, as a way to have access to the cultural, the linguistic setting that, you know, of the mainstream society. And so, you know, to hear the mother say, oh, well, you forget all these hearing people, you know, you're part of this deaf community, it seems almost as if, you know, there's this almost revisionist bias from that perspective to say, oh, this culture's always been here, it's always been flourishing and rich, and in reality, it hasn't. And
but the very fact that it has matured and has grown is the fear that it will not be able to continue to grow. All we'll be able to have with the decrease in the number of deaf people is not a blossoming deaf culture and language and community, but hopefully just the remnants of it or something like that, you know, is the worry in some degree. I mean, to that end, what's sort of like problematic, that's why in this article, for example, there's things like, it's referred to that some people think of cochlear implants as a eugenic sort of measure. So everyone knows the history of eugenics. Eugenics is the idea of the obliteration of populations for the sake of using biology or science as intervention. Well, taken from one perspective, if cochlear implants come in and suddenly there's no such thing as deafness anymore, we have killed a culture. We have destroyed a population in some particular way. We think we've given them a whole host of things, and we certainly have in terms of being able to hear and all that comes with that sort of thing. But quite technically, yeah, I can understand why someone would think that the stakes about what a cochlear implant provides could be that severe. Yeah.
I thought one of the mom's concerns was also like, how well does it actually work? So, like, in a situation where, like, if you tried to retain both cultures, like, in a school where you were practicing sign language, the speaking clearly was not as good. Like, she couldn't hear that, but she was told that, like, that first girl, the one that was talking about the rabbits, like, her speaking was not that great.
Yeah.
And so I think that was, like, an additional one of her concerns in terms of, like, well, it's either putting her in a speaking school where she will learn to speak well, or...
This is a hard part, too, in this one. And by the way, if you don't know, cochlear implants, the hearing that you are able to have is not quite up to the standard that we have, but it's something that at least gives a sense about the register. And some have described it as canned or tinny sort of hearing or something like that. Her speech, I don't know this woman's biography, this girl's biography, I don't know if it's because she's new and she's still learning to talk.
Okay.
Or it might just be the fact that that's what her speech is going to sound like, because it's equivalent to sort of what her hearing is like. Whatever that might be, the important thing to know is it's not like a switch is flipped and suddenly you're hearing and talking like everybody else. Why that's important, though, is this. There is a long history culturally of deaf people being treated as though they're stupid, because of the fact of how they talk or how they gesture, signs having all kinds of expressions and that sort of thing, that people historically and even presently sort of confuse an inability to hear with a lower sense of intelligence, so to speak. So that's just it's just a fact. Ask any sociologist, ask any anthropologist, ask any person with disability studies, it's true. The hearing world, even in sort of and think about it, I mean, sometimes I think if we speak to somebody who's hearing impaired or something, there's an attempt to want to slow down speech to enunciate. And we're doing it for a very practical sort of like reason, but it's just a half step away from feeling like you're speaking to someone who doesn't understand, you know? So to that end, there's a way in which the feeling is that, according to the hearing world, you know, am I being treated as though I'm not intelligent? Is a cochlear implant then an attempt not just to provide hearing for a person who has no hearing, but actually to make sure that that person has a presentation to the hearing world that isn't as being somehow mentally deficient? But the hard part is also true that once one first gets a cochlear implant, one's speech does sound not quite normal or what have you. To that degree, has alleviated the problem, it's only made it worse, so to speak. To that end, we keep thinking about cochlear implants as either doing a service to the person in question or a disservice to their deafness or the deaf community. But in some ways, it might also be about trying to serve to the perceptions of the hearing world as though I'm a fully functioning, intelligent sort of person. And that gives pause, if nothing else, you know? Then, yeah.
I mean, if these plans were, you know, impregnated into the idea of identity, then do you know if, like, a young person who's, like, 12 or 13 can sue in court to get their plan even though their parents don't want them to get it? You know, because you've seen it in trans communities where
yeah.
really young kids have sued for hormones and gone in, so...
Yeah.
I wonder if the argument would be the same.
I have heard of it happening. I don't know what the consensus is nationally, what have you. But in most cases, it's often deferred, which is to say, unlike a trans person where their very survivability through adolescence can depend upon whether or not their gender needs are met, I know that most adolescents or teens, by the time they have the wherewithal to request, I want a cochlear implant, my parents won't let me, they're often told, well, you'll be 18 in a couple of years, you can get it then, that sort of thing. Having said that, I think I have a vague recollection that if one claims that one's very mental health or sort of unlike trans patients, that's dependent on that. One could make an argument for it, but that's maybe the distinction to make there. But I don't think it's out of the question that there certainly are a lot of deaf and hard of hearing kids out there who probably want a cochlear implant, and their parents are like, I don't know. You know what I mean? So I don't think that's an uncommon story. Ashley, you had your hand up?
Yeah, on the subject of stupidity, I think part of it has to do with the grammar and syntax of sign itself. There's no, like, personal pronouns. So if you see a deaf person write, if they haven't been really properly taught English grammar, then they're going to come across as stupid regardless of how intelligent their point is because they don't write in a way that we understand.
Mm-hmm.
But on the subject of cochlear implants, I mean, the best candidate is a very, very, very young child. So by the time you're old enough to request it on your own and really understand what you're asking for and, you know, get yourself a lawyer and sue, you're almost out of the range at which it would be particularly useful for you, especially considering the amount of speech therapy that you would then have to go through, how much that would cost, whether or not you'd find some way to subsidize it if it would be paid for by insurance or if you would find someone who would be willing to give it to you. I mean, cochlear implants aren't some miracle. You know, they destroy the last vestiges of natural hearing that you have left in order to replace it with something electronic. So I don't know. I think
the only thing I take pause with is when you said that the young child is the best age. Well, I think best is a debatable sort of term. It's best in terms of the fact that it's most likely to take, and the hearing is most likely to improve, and the speech therapy is most likely to take. But that's not unusual to the analogy of, like, shit, I wish I learned Spanish when I was 9 instead of when I was 29 or what have you, because it takes a lot easier that way, you know what I mean? But there's a physical component too as well. Having said that, the ironic thing about this particular documentary is that by the time it gets to the end of the documentary and they say what happened to the story, the young girl gets a cochlear implant and so does Mom. Mom does too. I think actually one of the other people does as well.
The other kids all get them.
Yeah.
After we watched it last time, they got all the kids and the mom all got cochlear implants.
Yes, they did.
Once they were older, so you could understand her, but it definitely her speech would definitely been better if she had gotten them too.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So to that end, and there's a sequel to it. I forget what it's called.
Does it get into how they were treated by the other community?
Afterwards, there's a second documentary that's all about that. Sort of like what happened afterwards.
Yeah, it didn't really get that.
And I haven't seen that one. Let me tell you why I haven't seen the second one, although I should see it for this very reason, is I know that I have a lot of deaf friends who like this documentary because of its very hesitation on the matter, and it sort of doesn't really choose sides. From what I understand, the second one's a bit more of like, it works, you know? It's a bit more of that sort of pitch. So I don't know that it got the same.
The grandparents are like, thank God she finally saw the light kind of a thing.
That kind of thing, yeah. I think. Did you see the second one?
Yeah, I watched it all on YouTube.
Okay.
Because it wasn't on Netflix for whatever reason, so.
All right.
Somebody had put, like, parts.
Parts of it broken down. Do you know what it's called?
Sounded like Fury 6 years later.
Is that what it's called?
Like that.
Okay. I wasn't sure if it was called, like, you know, Hearing in Fury or something like that.
Sounded Fury, colon, 6 years later.
I know, right? It's catchy. I can just see it. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let me just direct you towards a couple of passages in this article to have a sort of bubble and thinking about this. Again, we're talking about cochlear implants in many ways because it provides a very literal example of trying to think about technology as enhancement or extension and how that actually is an incredibly loaded and complicated thing. I said that deaf culture is particularly rich and therefore it's rife for ethical concerns and worries here, but it's no different in terms of the way which we can think of other kinds of technology enhancing or perhaps rendering deficient our own abilities and identities. In fact, that's the distinction to think about here. We're trying to think about this difference between normalcy and enhancement. We're also trying to think about the distinction between disability and identity. So we can give one thing and take something else away, or vice versa, or neither. So to give you a couple of passages just for your own self to look at later if you've got a chance. On page 327, the middle paragraph on that page really is the one that talks about how there has always been a politics that has been attached to the way in which we understand hearing enhancement or hearing repair in some degree. A response to what's called deafening here, but that's a worthy paragraph of looking at. The other thing is to pay attention to would be, I would say, on page 336, and this is the section on deaf futurism. And I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs here to give us a sense about what we're talking about here in terms of technology providing a sense of futurity that's positive, or technology is providing a sense of futurity that feels fatalistic in some way. This says, narratives that depict the history of cochlear implants as a binary conflict between deaf culture and normative biomedicine additionally obscure the radical aspirations of a minority of deaf implant users. In a 1999 Hastings Center report, G.Q. McGuire and Ellen McGee contended that cochlear implants had, quote, set the stage for neuroenhancement. Three stages in the introduction of such devices can be delineated. The earliest adopters will be those with a disability who seek a more powerful prosthetic device. The next step represents the movement from therapy to enhancement. One of the first groups of non-disabled volunteers will probably be in the professional military, where the use of implanted computing and communication devices with new interfaces to weapons, information, and communications could be life-saving. The third group of users will probably be people involved in information-intensive businesses who will use the technology to develop an expanded information transfer capability. This linear evolutionary trajectory assigns deaf people to the primitive state and suggests a structural need for individuals with disabilities to serve as test beds for new technologies. It ignores the possibility that any person might desire enhancement rather than therapy from a prosthetic device. To that end, what we're worried about cochlear implants, and this is the thing about them as a futurity sort of advice, and it's going to harken back to what we talked about at the very beginning of the semester, is one of the ethically concerning things, just the narrative that we provide about how cochlear implants are valuable, not just to deaf people, to our culture. So quite often the narrative is often spun, that's what this paragraph is referring to. With this new technology, we can help people who are hard of hearing or have next to no hearing at all be able to enhance their sound. And it opens the door for all kinds of possibilities in the future for the ways that we can have mind-brain external technology interaction. Think of the ways in the military that we could be doing this, transferring information in ways that don't have to use speech. Think of the ways we could have connections between our mind and the technology that we work with, and on and on and on. According to that narrative, then, what does that make deaf persons use cochlear implants? The guinea pigs. They're the people that we test out new technology on, not so that we can help them, but if we can help them, then think of all other ways we can actually help ourselves. That's not unlike the very narrative, bioethical question and dilemma that we were having at the beginning of the 20th and the end of the 19th century. The one I told you about with, let's build hearing aids. Let's help deaf people be able to hear with a hearing aid. And then from there, let's make it into a telephone, let's make it into a transistor radio, and let's make it into this, into that, and let's think about doing it into walkie-talkies in the military. All of those technologies, walkie-talkies, Wi-Fi sort of communication orally, transistor radios, telephones, all of these come out of hearing aid technology. So there's a very parallel sort of like narrative that sort of happens there. Now, we're not poo-pooing hearing aids, and we're not poo-pooing all of these technologies that came out of it, but rather the fact that, well, what did it feel like for the deaf people then who had these first hearing aids? Were they the guinea pigs of their particular era? And people who are getting cochlear implants now, will they be grateful? Will the history show the fact that they were important agents? Or will it render them as simply being the test subjects and guinea pigs? So that suddenly what we're talking about here isn't even clinical ethics, but almost as though we're talking about research ethics now. Cochlear implants seem like an absolute clinical kind of intervention. But when we're using them as just a vehicle towards finding other kinds of technical advancement, then perhaps we're actually doing something we don't realize that we're doing, which is to say that we're using disabled persons with a certain kind of disability and trying to fix it or enhance it or restore it or what have you, but an attempt not really to help them, but maybe just to help the scientific narrative. And that's the deaf futurism that I'm talking about. Is this an optimistic sort of futuristic portrait, or is it a nihilistic, say, a fatalistic one, which is to say we have just turned science and medicine into a way in which human subjects in the clinic sort of become test subjects for technologies that we want to improve. And the fact that that narrative quite often leads to things that are in the capital marketplace or the military regime in terms of how those technologies work is perhaps part of what's problematic or troubling about some of that narrative. I just kind of wanted to leave it at that. I have no 100% opinion either way, and I don't think we can. I think what we're trying to just point out here is why there's pause about this particular kind of struggle in this particular moment. Any last thoughts about this before we move on? Okay, let's pull up the other two articles. Yeah?
So I found out the girl in this documentary is not at Georgetown.
She's a what at Georgetown?
She's a sophomore at Georgetown.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. What's the little girl who got the cochlear implant? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well,
that was pretty interesting.
Though. It worked. She'd be at Georgetown anyway, I bet, you know. But where'd you read it? Like on a news story or something? Or like
our guest lecturer yesterday. Mm. I talked to him afterwards, and that's what he told me.
Oh, because he'd seen this, or you asked about it? How was the guest lecturer yesterday, by the way?
It was really good. It a lot.
What was he talking about mostly? Some of this stuff about deaf culture, or more about sort of like his own experiences with cochlear implant, or a bit of both?
Yeah, I'd say a combination of the two, and kind of explaining the physiology of how the cochlear implant works, and you know, obviously with the medical crowd that was really delved to in detail. But outside of that, he did touch on kind of the ethics and the big debate surrounding it, but you know, he would label himself not a transhumanist, I think Dr. Moreno likes to use the term, but basically someone that, you know, I live in a hearing world and I want to make sure that I can position myself or my family for that world in which we live in, and that was kind of his philosophy.
Is he from a deaf family, or is he the sole deaf person in his family?
I think he was the sole deaf person, if
okay.
I remember correctly.
Just curious, that's all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Let's turn these other two articles out and pull them out and take a look at them. We're basically turning to talk about now surrogate decision-making, but it's actually in many ways a comparable topic we're talking about, which is to say, who is the authentic self, and how do we isolate what the authentic self is? This is an article that came out in AJOBS, American Journal of Bioethics, earlier this year, and I wrote one of the commentaries that was on it, basically positing the idea of what is it to think about the idea of using our online presence, the things we say online, as in some way evidentiary or in some way proof of what we actually want and our wishes are. In this case, in the need for surrogate decision making, so if someone's incapacitated in the hospital and in the absence of an advance directive, we need to make a healthcare choice on their behalf, but we have no documentation or advance directive to give us a sense of what they wanted, is it ethically appropriate for us to use online or digital sort of commentary as evidence in some way for what that person might want? Can I have a volunteer for somebody to read the case out loud for us that was written by Jessica Berg here? Yeah, be great.
Mr. M is a 47-year-old white male who has had serious health problems for a number of years, severe hypertension, chronic renal failure, and congestive heart failure. Despite these problems, he has led an active life. He has been married for 3 years and has no children. He works as a computer science professor at a local community college. 4 days ago, he developed a sudden severe headache and chest pain, which was not relieved with nitroglycerin. An ambulance brought him to the emergency room where he presented in a comatose state. A CT scan was done promptly and showed a subdural hematoma. Neurosurgery was consulted and the patient was taken to the operating room where the hematoma was evacuated. Mr. M remains relatively stable on ventilator support but shows no neurologic improvement despite maximal treatment. Mr. M's wife has been asked to make decisions about his care. As is the case with the vast majority of patients, Mr. M has left no advance directive or living will. Mrs. M, however, points out that he has discussed his medical situation in great detail on his Facebook page and included statements about his wishes for future care. In addition, his sister has a record of his tweets in response to the shooting of Representative Giffords in Arizona and his thoughts about whether he would want care if he were seriously disabled. May the information on Facebook or Twitter be used to inform surrogate decisions about his care? Should they be used? What legal and ethical concerns are raised?
Okay. If you got a chance to take a look at the short piece I wrote, it was basically a whole host of questions to ask when trying to consider this particular kind of evidence. Taking this case at hand, though, let's hear some thoughts. What are your thoughts about whether or not, based on what you read or just your own opinion, about whether or not the postings we make online, not just on Facebook but elsewhere, the things that we do, our activities online, the purchases we make, the sites we look at, what have you, should in some way at least not be proof, but a part of the evidence that we use for trying to make a surrogate decision-making. Sam?
I think it depends on, like, how thoughtful, like, what you actually write on Facebook or Twitter is. Because, like, for example, I had the ex that wrote crazy things on Facebook and Twitter, and even posted some medical records of mine, like I was saying in the last class. Mm-hmm. And so, like...
Where are you meeting these people, Sam?
Mm-hmm. She was from Baylor.
Okay. Note to self. Avoid Baylor.
Yeah, Baylor's medical school.
No, but I think she's not unique, though, in terms of the, like, saying crazy things online or what have you. Yeah, so let's think of some examples, then. What would count? What would count as something that you would want to count? Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not counting, but, for example, you know, after the election, a series of people were prosecuted for making threats on Facebook and on Twitter about the president, right? I mean, those were taken very seriously, and they were counted as almost secondary actions. And so,
yeah.
I mean, those are words on a social network manifest as actions with real-world consequences. So.
And that's a wonderful example in terms of the... We might think that because it's online or because it's just Facebook or what have you, that what we're saying does not carry that much gravitas attached to it. But clearly, in certain circumstances, it can. Now, that's a case of somebody just saying something and then after the fact being like, oh, what you said is actually really fucking serious, you know?
I wonder if it's a little different.
And this is a case. This case is about trying to say, can I retroactively go back to what someone said and try to attach gravitas to it in terms of making a health choice?
Like, I think in those situations, you're trying to take, like, the cautionary approach, right? Like, somebody makes a threat versus a threat against the president. The cautionary approach is like, all right, figure out who that person is, make sure they're not actually going to kill the president and prosecute them. Like, in the reverse situation, you're talking about, like, somebody making a decision about, like, pulling the plug or, like, life or death. I think the cautionary approach is more like, maybe let them live and see if they... I don't know, at least that's how I imagine it.
Yeah.
So I think you would react to them differently. Like, so whether or not on... We obviously clearly need to hash out more, like, what sort of things online are posted or that are okay to, like, follow up on. But my hunch is that the cautionary approach, in either case, even if somebody says something that you may not believe, the cautionary approach would be, like, don't pull the plug.
Yeah, no, I would agree that, like, when it comes to a threat on the president's life, the threshold is probably a lot lower. The bar is probably in terms of whether to take it seriously or not. Whereas if I went online to Facebook and I was like, I'm going to kill you, Ethan. Like, I don't think you'd be arrested tonight, you know?
I don't know. I mean, I...
Let's try.
Dear Amy, I actually think it would be the other way because, I mean, we are responsible for everything that we communicate, right? And if you have a Facebook, right, that's representative of your identity, right? And the way that it's supposed to work is that you have its password belongs exclusively to you and what you broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of you. I mean, as a sane human being with a legitimate sense of you know, intelligence, you have to come up with these thoughts. You're not just throwing them out there. And so why not give the same sense of weight? I mean, if I wrote on there, you know, I'm going to go after so-and-so versus, well, actually, you know, if something ever happens to me and pull the plug, then how can we actually make that judgment?
Yeah, I think to make the distinction between threatening your life and threatening the president's, I would probably be held equally accountable for saying those things. I just wouldn't have a SWAT team on my front step tonight if I said it about you. The reaction would be different. But in terms of whether I said something about, everybody remembers Representative Giffords, right, who got shot by the guy who was crazy, and then she was, you know, in a coma for a while and had speech therapy and PT and all sort of stuff. And there was all discussions about, you know, what would you do in her case and that sort of thing. So this is referring that moment. If you had made comments about that case, or if this, in this case, this Mr. M has or what have you, do you guys think that that would be reliable sort of comment on what he'd want. Yeah.
I would think, you know, regarding end-of-life decisions, they'd have to be very explicit. Like, if it was on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, it's like, in the event of this, I want this. Yeah, I want it. Should be clear as day. If someone just posted an article about Giffords and just said, well, that sucks. You know, anything.
which is the typical language.
Right. I would not take anything short of clear as day.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't take, oh, that sucks to me. Oh, they must not want that.
Yeah.
Unless it's right. Unless it's black and white. You know, this is what I want. I would not put any weight on any other comments.
No emoticons.
Because
right. if it says wink, wink, smiley face.
Right. And why would you not put any weight on it then? Just on erring on the side of?
Because, I mean, at least in my opinion, like people on Facebook or on the internet, they have much more. I guess you're much more likely to put something off the cuff. Or something more extreme than you actually would in real life. And I think a lot of people just treat it as a place to speak. I'm bored. I need to talk. I want someone to hear what I have to say. Here's what I ate for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or something like that. And it's just like, I don't put as much weight in anything I read on Facebook or Twitter.
Although people are like that in life, though, too. You know what I mean? But the problem is that even if it just means we garner a shade of the casual offhand commentary sort of leaked to what people say online, that tempers also not just the way we read it, but the way people also approach it at the same time, I think you're speaking to. Jamie?
The reality is that you're not going to say this is what the person wanted on Facebook and do it. The reality is that you go to the proxy decision maker, in this case the wife, and say, what do you think he would have wanted?
Yeah.
So whether she explicitly says, oh, here's his Facebook postings, or takes that into account, I think it's pretty similar to having a conversation with someone, and you know, when people go back to the nuggets at the dinner table, oh, we were discussing this once and he said this.
Yeah.
I think it's actually very much in line with that.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you compare it, like I keep thinking, you know how Autumn always tells us, this is what I want, whenever this comes up in her intro class. I think that it's almost easier to take it from Facebook or Twitter where it's actually written and you know there's not that misinterpretation or that failed memory that
like,
you weren't
that
sure
word.
Exactly what they said, there it is. You can go back to the original source, even when this person's not able to say, no, this is what I said.
Yeah.
And then obviously the question is how much thought is behind it. But I think there's probably just as much thought between a lot of this as there is in the dinner table conversation, which is what a lot of this falls onto.
True. Anybody else thoughts on that?
What about private versus like public platforms? Like Twitter, if I'm opening up, anyone can follow me, for example, but like Facebook is an enclosed space, right?
Yeah.
And so I was thinking, you know, things like this, you know, like decision making, what we say in the public space, like you can throw anything on Twitter and it becomes this like public conversation, right? But I don't know, I wonder if on Facebook, and I'm not saying one way or the other, but you know, given that we are among colleagues and friends and people that know us, I wonder if there is particularly more weight given to that medium just because, you know, oh, here, you know, in this group of 1,000 people, 200 people I know and care for, you know, versus on Twitter where, you know, who knows who's following you.
Right. Anybody else?
Well, people already use Facebook somewhat formally with all those copyright things that people post, mainly related to, like, Facebook's right to do whatever. I wonder if anyone ever said something more formally with regards to what they want in terms of their healthcare.
Venue?
Yeah, people use it as, like, a casual form, and then also there will be, like, extremely formal legal speak that will suddenly, like, pop up.
Right,
so
right.
People do that.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was a prank recently. Like, there was somebody had sent out, like, this, like...
Who knows?
Yeah.
A prank.
Well, I mean, and that prank could be making your healthcare decisions in the future for you. Yeah. No, I mean, I think the thing to note, and if you want to turn towards the article that I wrote, I mean, I'm basically arguing to some degree that, like, you know, Facebook, digital media, this kind of evidence is suspect, it's suspicious, it has concerns about it, about whether it's authentic or not reliable. But at the same time, it's no different than reading someone's diary or reading someone's note, or like Jamie said, remembering that dinner conversation that somebody had. In fact, the truth is we're suspicious of all those things. It's almost about trying to corroborate the evidence that we find. It's almost about trying to find multiple instances of it in order to make sure that it's appropriate. It's almost about trying to make it sound like that does sound like Stephen or Mr. M in this case, or what they would have wanted. Let's turn actually towards a couple of the ways that I've broken down the case here, just to think about some of these questions. And I do this because one of the next Posteris sort of assignments to have is to sort of look for something on your own Facebook profile or somebody else's that's a friend of yours or whatever, and just say, here's a sentence someone wrote. Don't tell us who it is or anything. But here's the ways one could read into what that person wrote. In other words, I think the comments that we make in passing have the potential to be very loaded, and that can be revealing in a good way for what I want, but also frightening in the way that I could have said something in passing and someone could have taken that out of context and meant something else. What I've done is taken sort of narrative theory and said that a good way to understand whether something is reliable is a kind of testimonial to what someone wants, whether it's in a diary or a letter or an email or an online posting on Facebook or whatever, is often to think about how does it fit within a particular sort of like kind of narrative understanding. To that end, I talk about genre, audience, context, intention, and prevalence. I'm not going to read through all these questions, but I do think it's a good way for us to break down maybe the way with which we can actually not just dissect, but also be scrutinous, but also suspicious when trying to think about the way in which digital evidence can be a reliable reminder to us, whether or not it's authentic in some particular way, whether it is the normal, the deficient, or the enhanced sort of like identity that someone has. So under genre, there's a couple of questions here. I'll just read a few. In what format or through what host does the digital testimony appear? Is if it is on Facebook, for example, does it constitute a wall post, a commentary, a private communication, or other feature? How do these differing locations alter the earnestness and certainty of the digital evidence being studied? So, if I said that it was really a shame what happened to so-and-so Giffords, hope that never happens to me if I'm in her condition, did I write that on my Facebook profile? Did I write that in a public chat room? Did I write that at the bottom of a news article at my local newspaper, at the bottom tucked in there under my handle, whatever it might be? Did I write it on my blog on bigtits.com or whatever, you know? I mean, like the context, the site that it's on, it makes a difference. It makes a difference, you know, where we're seeing it at. So just bear that in mind. Let's turn to the next category, audience. If this is a private communication, who is the correspondent, and how does the identity of this person adjust our interpretation? So not unlike a letter, if you were to use, for example. Who is the person that's this being told to? So for example, and this is why the audience matters as well, you know, because quite often people will say very loaded things because what they're doing is not actually saying what their true opinion is, but the opinion that they think the audience wants to hear. And certainly people say this shit all the time online, don't they? I mean, how often are people saying an exaggerated version of what they believe, or even some manipulation of what they believe because they know it's just going to be the most incendiary or inflammatory thing and therefore get the most hits or posts or responses or what have you. So to know the context and the audience is actually to change it or change it. Whereas if I had said something in my private chat room on Facebook or something in a communication just between someone I care about, no, Tom would have told Brenda what he really wanted. That he wrote this to Brenda is a significant detail or fact to bear in mind, those kind of distinctions. If public, who is the likely readership? Is Mr. M writing in solidarity with his readers or in reaction to them? Does this affect whether we interpret his comments as proof of his enduring principles or as evidence of his circumstantial audience-specific interjections? So, you know, somebody writes something about the Giffords case, and it's about, you know, I would or would not want to be in the same position if I had been the recipient of this, but it's posted on one's chat room on NRA.com, you know? Well, one's wondering, were they saying that because it was in the context of a gun control sort of website, so to speak, and therefore they were erring on the side. But truthfully, I knew Tom, and Tom, in his true heart, probably would have said X, Y, or Z, or what have you. So whether or not it feels appropriate to where it's coming from. Context is the next category here. Is the commentary by Mr. M pertinent to the healthcare decisions that are being made on his behalf? Is it a related manner or only tangentially applicable? So Mr. M says, I wouldn't have wanted this if this happened to me about Representative Giffords, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, a month later, Mr. M gets into a car accident and is incapacitated. So what he said about Representative Giffords, is that what he meant about life support? Is that what he meant about having to go through therapy in order to recover? Or is that just what he meant if he got himself shot, you know, had a shot by a gun or what have you? Is it applicable or isn't it? How is it the same or not? Is it tangentially or is it immediately sort of related? Has Mr. M posted comments online on a subject matter in the abstract or a specific relevant case or on matters autobiographical? Are the comments by Mr. M and or those he responds to written in an emotional register that suggests they are germane to the magnitude and solemnity of the surrogate decisions that are being made on his behalf? If not, then are they still elucidating on what his healthcare wishes might be? This is the hard part I think we have about thinking about commentary online, whatever website it's on and whatever sort of context, and whether our emoticons or not, which is to say, this is perhaps one of the most serious decisions I'm going to have to make when it comes to certain decision making. Is the internet really a serious thing? Can it be? You know, I could have written a very serious, you know, to use the example, a very serious sort of like heartfelt statement about Representative Giffords and what I would have wanted in that position, and then ended it with an emoticon like frowny face. And suddenly it makes us wonder, well, this is online. It's not the same thing, you know? The thing I'll say to you all, though, is that when making surrogate decisions without an advanced directive, in almost every case you're grasping. You're trying to find what does the person want, what's authentic, what's serious, where's the gravitas, that sort of thing. So the internet is something that we register with it in kind of suspicion or worry because it doesn't seem as significant or important enough. But when you get to these decisions without it, and I think it's because of the contrast. In comparison to an advanced directive, which is legally binding, official, specific, and approved, written in very professional language, everything else is just hearsay. Yep.
The other thing is, this almost makes me think of, it's all about what you're telling the people you're working with. So, like, if somebody comes to this decision based off of what they read in Facebook and Twitter, but then they don't mention it, and they say, no, this is what he wanted, he's expressed it, blah, 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 you might take it more at face value. And it's a weird parallel, but it's almost coming into my head as well. Like, if you come and say, I want to abort this baby because it's a boy, mm-hmm. nobody would do it. But if you say, no, I just am not ready for a child, I don't want it, it's all about how you present where your information is and what you're really thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So there's probably a lot of this going on, too, where we're debating on the ethical merits of using this information, but people are probably using it and not crediting it
mm-hmm.
anyway.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think so. And I think that's sort of, in the last section here, there's one on intention this I have here that talks about, you know, who do they intend to write it for and that sort of thing. But the prevalence one is kind of important. To the degree where the questions basically that I've listed say, have the opinions expressed appeared in more than one instance? Have they appeared across different genres for different audiences over an extended period of time? Are the virtual opinions and statements consistent or inconsistent with other forms of non-digital testimony from Mr. M? Do his online postings conform, conflict with, clarify, or distort our understandings of Mr. M's wishes based on his physical conversations with loved ones or the writings he made in non-digital formats? Are Mr. M's postings those of the man or his virtual alter ego? Should one be respected more than the other? This is sort of the thought about authenticity. Part about when we have handles or avatars or what have you online, it's this idea of how reliable is what we say online a true testament to who I really am and what I really believe? Is that me in my online self or is that me in my real self? And the question is simply, I think, this idea of prevalence, which is to say how valuable I think digital testimony can be towards how it allows us to know what a patient wants is whether or not it sounds wildly different than the person that we actually knew, you know? To that end, we see this debate all the time, too, when somebody comes up and says, no, I talked to Tom, and Tom said he wouldn't want this. Well, then his wife, Susan, is like, that doesn't sound like Tom to me, that sort of thing. And then this is the hard part about decision-making. There becomes this sort of debate, well, who is he really, and what did he really want? And my point, and I think the point about digital media and the information that's out there, is that not only should it be treated with the same kind of question and suspicion and scrutiny that we do other things, but maybe just a little extra because of the fact that there's such a diversified palette of ways with which one can testify online in lots of different formats and ways. To that end, would you think that there would be any pause that someone should have to need to, you know, root out what not just someone posts on Facebook, but what someone, a book, books they bought at Amazon, or searches they had on Google in the last couple of years, or anything like that? Again, it's just more evidence, but how we interpret, how we read it is the part that's hard. Do you think that's terrain that we should consider in play or out of play?
I don't think any one of these sort of electronic like pieces of evidence would really resonate with me, but this idea of consistency, like if someone were able to present to me, if I were in the shoes of the physician, and say, look, they like read these books, they posted these like four things on Facebook, these things on Twitter, like collectively that would be really poignant. But any one given piece of evidence, maybe not so much.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not that different from trying to think, you know, whether or not one has a convincing case or not. It's the prevalence and the amount of evidence that sways rather than just a singular sort of instance.
I think you're probably rank them at a higher, at least like a
a hierarchy of which ones might be more powerful and like convincers. Like, I think what books they bought, like, you don't know their reaction to the book. Like, did they agree with the subject matter or disagree? And so I feel like that one's kind of harder to, whereas like Facebook or like internet searches or, I don't know. I think that might.
It can change. It can vary. So, for example, a pregnant woman is on a life support machine and she's early into her pregnancy with a very, you know, unlikely chance of recovery and, frankly, using a lot of resources and a lot of expense. And the husband is adamant that, no, she would want to stay on a life support machine all the way until she can carry that child to term, whatever. Mm. Well, guess what? On Amazon, she bought 800 books that were about pro-life this and pro-life that and so on and so forth. Well, that might be convincing evidence that maybe that would be something that she would want. It wouldn't be a compromise to her dignity and what she wanted, because that was totally random example. But, you know, but you're right. There's probably 1,000 others where someone could sort of misinterpret what one buys or what one reads online with what one actually experiences or believes in some way. Anybody else? Thoughts about casting the net wide to try to figure out who someone is and what someone's wishes are in the absence of an advance directive. It's a hard one to think about in the sense that, like I said, I think it has a lot to do with by comparison compared to an advance directive, which, let's say, there's no shortage of instances also where somebody has an advance directive and says, I don't want this to happen to me. And then the person who is the surrogate decision maker is like, I don't care what that advance directive is. He actually changed his mind, I think. You know, I think he actually wants this. I remember him telling me and that sort of thing. So it's not that we have any document that's 100% fixed. I think the hard part becomes in the absence of multiple iterations of what somebody wants, but in the presence of a single comment, even if it's a lengthy one online, that sounds very explicit about what that person wants, if that's the singular piece of evidence, how reliable is it and how much can we trust it? And that becomes difficult, I think, because of the very genre of what digital media is, and I think because of this very relationship between the fact that whatever we put in this digital media technology in some ways is a positive extension of who I am. And in other ways, it feels like it might be to another person entirely. So trying to figure out where the authenticity lies in that situation is a difficult one. Then, in this case, we're just applying it to surrogate decision-making, but I think it actually holds true into a whole host of other sort of experiences and moments that happen with digital media as well. Any last thoughts or questions that we have right now? Everybody's doing well on their Posteris posts, and I'm probably going to post a couple more, so that way probably people have plenty of time and iteration and chances to post on things. Don't forget you can post on anything the hell you want. And a cheap and easy way to post things, too, is also to respond to your classmates and stuff with a substantial sort of response. It's a good way to actually make sure that what we're doing in this class and what those posts is engaging on multiple issues in a way that's concise but precise at the same time. You got a question?
Yeah, just a quick question.
Yeah.
Has there been, say, like legal precedents, or I know you do a lot with clinical mediation or ethics consultations, is there like a set standard that people usually follow in regards to, say, like Twitter and Facebook? Like, have we seen any like big court cases that have come up with this, or
about surrogate decision making, or about
surrogate decision making in kind of this like digital media form?
There is no standard. There isn't. No. In fact, in many ways, this article is written as a way that there's a large gaping hole here in terms of. But to be quite honest with you, surrogate decision making in general, in terms of what counts as reliable evidence, tends to be quite varied. So in some jurisdictions, in some legal cases, it's been quite irrefutable that if somebody wrote that in their personal diary, then in some way, you know, we tend to think of diaries like that as having two audiences only, myself, and then in posterity of when I'm gone, they'll read my memoirs and yada, 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 you know? So in some ways, we tend to think they're more reliable, but they can be full of shit, too, you know? Diaries can, you know? How many of us had a diary when we were younger or have one now? And then I went to the store, and I crossed that part out, and I remember that, you know? So, you know, shade, little temper, little, you know? So there has been some precedence with documents like that, but even then, you know, in general, trying to find something to use as evidence for what someone's wishes were, there's hardly any definitive precedent outside of the advance directive. So digital media is just sort of the latest incarnation of something. It's just a complicated one because in terms of what we leave behind as written evidence of what our beliefs were, in the past pretty much amounted to diaries, letters to friends, you know, perhaps, you know, if we published something or if we got a will drawn up or what have you. But now the truth is with digital media, with the internet and with email, we all write a shitload more than our predecessors 20, 30, 40 years ago. But with all of that written stuff then, is that evidence? Is it not? Or is it just mindless conversation, if you will, to some degree? Which is to say, the troubling thing maybe about digital media is that maybe now more than ever, at least in the past maybe 100 years or so, we're all leaving potentially a lot more written testimony and evidence behind us when we leave than we maybe ever have before. And that's at once touching, I guess, but worrisome, too, in the sense that I may have just written something on Facebook and not realize that 20 years down the road it might actually be culled out and used to make a decision on my behalf. And it's just something to bear in mind going forward, because it's almost some sort of new terrain that we're sort of on. So I'm going to stop there. Thanks, everybody, for a great semester. Don't leave yet. I have evals for you guys to fill out, but I want to say thanks so much, and bye.
Regarding the postings...
What's that?
When's the final for the account?
When's the final? Oh, well, you can do this as late as the 21st or the 22nd. Okay. So a couple weeks, just plenty of time. Those who haven't started doing them yet, don't worry. You know, sit down on a Saturday and turn them out, you know. Another question or say one? Okay, good.